This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guests this morning are Michael Brown, Professor of Geography, and Richard Morrill, Professor Emeritus of Geography at the University of Washington. Michael is an urban, political, and cultural geographer who studies sexuality and health in Seattle. Richard is a human geographer with particular interest in population, inequality, and urban and regional planning. Michael Brown and Richard Morrill are here today to tell us about the book they co-edited titled Seattle Geographies. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
What led you or prompted you to write the book Seattle Geographies?
There were several factors. The first was that it's the 75th anniversary of the Geography Department at the University of Washington, so we wanted to do something to sort of commemorate that anniversary. The second reason was that the Association of American Geographers was holding their annual meeting in Seattle in 2011, and about 7,000 geographers descended on the city, and we wanted to give them something so that they could learn about the city and where they were visiting. And thirdly, the department has always had a very strong commitment to the city, the region, the state, and we wanted to do something to kind of tie all that together, to do something that tied all our very disparate interests together into a single volume that we could show folks just what geographers do around here, and also to use as a teaching tool.
And the fourth would be that we have, an amazingly talented faculty and set of students who actually know a lot about this area. And I think we have a responsibility to let the public know the kind of work we do.
Who contributed to the book?
This book was actually an incredibly collaborative and team effort. We had retired faculty, we had present faculty in the geography department, we had graduate students, and we even had undergraduates contribute. So this is really a broad reflection of one academic unit's take on the region.
For the purposes of your book, how are you defining Seattle? What areas included?
We were loose about that. So sometimes we were talking about the city of Seattle as a political entity, sometimes the whole metropolitan area. In fact, that was probably the most common. And sometimes the Seattle region of influence, and that could go all the way to Montana. Or when we're talking about global geography, it would be our relationship to China and Japan, so in Alaska.
Would you say a few words about the different types of geographies you consider in your book?
Sure. Geography is a very strange beast that everyone sort of has a vague sense of from kind of seventh grade, but they really don't exactly know what it is. And the best way to explain geography, I think, is to compare it with history. There can be a history of everything because history emphasizes the sort of temporal unfolding of events. Geographers look at space and place. They look at the spatial organization and unfolding of phenomena. So the discipline can be organized in multiple ways. The primary way we chose to organize the book, though, was systematically. So, for example, we have a chapter on economic geography. We have a chapter on political geography. We have a chapter on social geography. We have a chapter on cultural geography. But we also have chapters on rural geographies, which reflects a more regional focus, as well as a chapter on global geographies, which reflects a more kind of spatial perspective on phenomena. So there isn't a single organizing principle of the discipline to the book, but that actually reflects the reality of how the discipline is these days.
As geographers, what do you consider distinctive about Seattle as a place?
Seattle is a regional capital, and it has achieved this goal of being a global city. But it is also a home to some 3 million, at least the region, home to some 3 million people who are tremendously varied. And we talk about what makes Seattle special, and just as an example, we have an unusually high level of education and professional kinds of workers, which makes us a little bit different from many other cities. Another interesting point is that Seattle really does have a high level of tolerance for diverse people and lifestyles.
Dick, do you want to say something about the ethnic and racial uniqueness of the area?
Well, Seattle would be viewed, comparing it to the rest of the country, as a relatively white city in the sense that we don't have a large African-American population. But on the other hand, we have quite a high Asian population, and this reflects our position on the Pacific. And so that's somewhat distinctive about Seattle.
In your book, you point out that Seattle has the highest per capita income and wealth in the Pacific Northwest. Why is this the case?
Well, the cities, as Marx said long ago, earn money from their hinterland. And so Seattle is not only the home of very productive industries and very successful entrepreneurial activities, but we are the destination for services from people in a very wide region. So if you're in western Montana or northern Idaho and you need some kind of specialized care, you come to the Seattle, big Seattle hospitals. If you want to go to professional sports, you come to Seattle and spend a few days and lots of money. So that contributes to how successful Seattle is by not only being productive locally, but by earning money from the rest of the region.
One aspect of economic geography that you discuss in your book is the relation of where jobs are located to where people live. Where are the jobs in Seattle located?
Well, every city has an imbalance of jobs and people. And ours is not actually any worse than most other big cities, but we do have large concentrations of jobs, say, in the Green River Valley relative to fewer people, in very big concentration downtown Seattle, South Lake Union, and also in Bellevue and in Redmond. But the people live in a much broader area, including almost out to the foothills. So this forces people to do a fair amount of commuting.
Would you comment on our commuting issues here?
Seattle would be one of the more difficult commuting situations, sort of like San Francisco, in part because of the sheer physical geography, the lakes, the many bridges. This forces traffic to be in tough bottlenecks that are difficult and expensive to deal with, as witness the fight over 520 or over the viaduct. And the book does talk into some of these interesting battles and the sort of their history and why we keep fighting these over and over again.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guests are Michael Brown, Professor of Geography, and Richard Morrill, Professor Emeritus of Geography at the University of Washington. Our topic is the book they co-edited, titled Seattle Geographies, and you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Let's talk now about political geography. In a general sense, what do political geographies entail? What's included?
Well, one kind of political geography is the actual jurisdictions, why you have counties and cities and special districts. Our region is famous for having an amazing variety of local governments instead of a few big ones. We have hundreds of little ones. So that's one aspect, and it's sort of interesting. The fight to get some kind of regional solutions has been long and slow, but we've done a little bit. A typical example would be in the 1960s, when I was much younger, we had the sewage going into Lake Washington. They had to close the beaches, and people didn't want to vote to put in a good sewer system, so eventually we were forced to do it. So that started creating the metropolitan institutions. A second part of political geography is elections and voting. Why do we have areas that vote conservative or liberal or democratic or Republican? So several chapters in the book focus on the kind of partisan and geography, both in a political party sense and in the socially liberal versus socially conservative sense.
Going back to the different jurisdictions, would you say more about that and give some examples of the jurisdictions that exist here that are particularly unique to this area?
Well, I'm not up to date with how many cities we have. Under the Growth Management Act, we were encouraged to reduce the number of special districts and to create more cities. But even so, King County still has dozens of fire districts and dozens of water districts and sewer districts and library districts and mosquito abatement districts and park districts. And so we're famous for creating a new authority to do something rather than letting a general government do it, because we're afraid of big government. And that's not unusual.
Would you say more about why these jurisdictions originally were formed?
That goes back to the early part of the 20th century, when the system of creating special districts was permitted as a way to avoid incorporation. People were afraid of more taxes, and they mistakenly thought if they could have special districts, then they would avoid the general purpose government higher taxes of Seattle. But of course, they ended up paying a little bit for this water district, a little bit for that fire district, and a little more for the school district. And so it was an illusion that they were really saving money. So in recent years, we've had a tendency to people finally to give up their being part of the county and become cities, or being annexed, like the recent new annexation to Kirkland would be an example.
And what was some of the negative fallout of having all these different jurisdictions? What are some examples of things that didn't go as well as they might have?
One example would be that creating an actual city that has incorporated helps create a sense of place and sense of identity for people. Whereas if you were just part of unincorporated King County, unincorporated Pierce County, you're not clear where you really were. Are you part of your school districts, or what are you really part of?
Political geographers use the term balkanization to refer to this sort of mismatch of overlaid jurisdictions. And one of the dilemmas that balkanized areas have, or citizens who live in them, is they're not quite sure where they are in a jurisdictional sense. Am I in Mosquito District 5, or am I in Fire District 7, or both, or neither? And while that kind of diffuses political authority, it also diffuses political responsibility. And sometimes that's hard for the everyday citizen to track and hold these things accountable. So it can lead to very long voting cards. It can lead to confusion over the responsibilities of what jurisdictions and local governments do and do not do. And that's one problem.
Let's now look at Seattle's social geographies. First, before we go into any detail, would you just give an overview of what social geographies entail? What types of things?
Well, social geography involves, on one side, population, how many people there are, but that's only the numbers. What's more interesting is what kind of households are they? Are they singles? Are they married? Do they have children? Are they old? Do grandparents take care of the grandkids? So that's the social side. But that also involves how educated people are and whether they're in school. So it's sort of the social characteristics. But beyond those, the social geography of Seattle is fascinating because we have an unusually, especially close in, an unusually high share of single people and a relatively low share of families with children in the close-in parts of the metropolis. And we have an unusually high share of unmarried households, both same-sex and opposite-sex. And that makes Seattle somewhat distinctive. So that's all part of what we call social geography.
It's the geographies of kind of people living their everyday lives, of groups, of, as Dick said, demographics, but also the spatial dimensions of where people make their homes, how they go to school, what their neighborhoods are like. Those sorts of things are considered social geography.
And obviously a big part, too, would be the kind of housing people live in. Where are single-family houses versus apartments located, and why do we have these? And, of course, a lot of Seattle's current controversy has to do with the nature of what the city will look like in the future.
Would you say more about the demographics? You've referred a bit to that already, but could you say more about who lives in Seattle and why?
Well, the whole metropolis has every possible kind of household and population, and we have quite a young population metropolitan-wise, and therefore we have lots of families and lots of children, so we're not unusual in that respect. The city of Seattle is a little bit special because it's just 1/6 of the region, and it's the oldest and most crowded part, and so we have a relatively higher share of apartments and a higher share of renters, and a smaller share of families, because families with children, especially if they're over 5 in the schools, tend to move out to the suburbs where there's more space.
And how does the distribution look in terms of race, for example, and also income?
Well, we're unusual in the race situation. Most big cities have high concentrations of racial minorities in the central city and relatively whiter suburbs. Seattle has changed because Seattle has gentrified so much that a lot of the minority populations have moved out to the suburbs themselves or been displaced out. So in the case of Seattle, the highest concentration of minorities is South King County, reaching down into Pierce County. In fact, so if we were to think about a new congressional district, one possibility would be to have a minority district in South King County. It's quite remarkable.
And what do you see as the implications of the demographic patterns in Seattle in terms of how the city functions and what issues come forward?
Well, I think gentrification is obviously a key factor here, that gentrification is usually defined as a class change from people of poor and working class areas shifting to more upper class and higher income areas. And with that often comes a whitening of neighborhoods. But the effects can be both good and bad, as it were, depending on one's perspective. So, for example, a graduate student named Gary Simonson reported on his research in the Columbia City neighborhood area of Seattle, which was historically an African-American neighborhood, experienced quite rapid and intense gentrification through the 90s, in no small part because of city policies designed to promote economic development. And there was a very clear class shift and racial shift in the neighborhood. And what Gary did was, rather than trying to measure that, he focused in on the stayers, the people who had lived through this process in Columbia City. And he detected a real ambivalence. They were proud of their neighborhood. They were proud that their neighborhood was economically doing better. They appreciated that things looked better in terms of the landscape. But they spoke of losing a sense of community, of feeling a bit alienated in their own neighborhood, of not being able to afford to go to some of the trendy new shops that had opened. So the question they were left with was, who is this really better for?
And what are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts on that is that this is something that is happening all over Seattle, and I think Columbia City is just one end of it. Certainly when my partner and I were looking for housing, real estate agents kept pushing us to the Central District in Seattle, which historically was the middle-class African-American neighborhood. And I think as a gay couple, we were seen as archetypical gentrifiers. And I think this process is probably happening all over Seattle, Beacon Hill, South Seattle, what have you.
Ballard and Greenwood are perhaps current examples of gentrification. And one may wish it hadn't happened in some cases, but it's part of the almost inevitable processes of people making decisions about where and how to live.
And I think there's a lot of sort of unintended consequences. So on the first hand, there's a kind of question of spatial and social justice. Who has the right to the city? Who has ease of access to public space in the city, given these rapid class and racial shifts in the city? But also, Dick spoke earlier of commuting patterns. Gentrifying areas can complicate commuting patterns quite interestingly. So, for example, we have a lot of Microsofties who are part of the gentrification process in central Seattle neighborhoods, but of course they have to get over the bridge in the other way. And so they contribute potentially to traffic issues, but not in the way we typically think of suburbanites coming into the city at 9 a.m. and leaving at 5, although obviously there is that in the city as well.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guests are Michael Brown, Professor of Geography, and Richard Morrill, Professor Emeritus of Geography at the University of Washington. Our topic is the book they co-edited titled Seattle Geographies. Would you comment on the relation of Seattle to nearby rural areas, both cultural and economically? You have a chapter in the book on that topic?
We do. We have some wonderful colleagues who do not focus on urban issues in Seattle per se, but we wanted them to be very much a part of this book. And so they wrote a chapter on rural geographies, and they make a very compelling argument that you really can't understand Seattle without understanding what's going on in its rural hinterland. And they define that very broadly, from Oregon, Idaho, western Montana, as well as the rural areas within Washington state. And they chart recent demographic and economic trends there, and they classify these places into three areas: playgrounds, dumping grounds, and unseen areas. And the playgrounds are what we might think of as rural gentrification. These are the amenity-rich places in the West. These are places where retirees are flocking to, where resorts are cropping up. And these are rather successful, although there is an economic shift in the base of these economies, moving from agricultural to more tourist and service economies. The dumping grounds are areas that have become economically successful, put that in quotes, as a place to take others' problems. So, for example, rural areas that accept landfills or prisons, and we have a section on that about various counties trying to build prisons as an economic development engine with some decidedly mixed results. And then there are the unseen grounds, which are the areas that sort of have been left off the economic success stories of rural areas. These are areas with intense poverty. These might be areas where the agricultural economy isn't as productive as it had been, and people are trying to cope with those changes in place, and it's very difficult to. These might be areas of racial segregation with migrant farm workers, things of that nature. And these are often off the beaten path, and they're very difficult to see.
What aspects of our geography make Seattle, Seattle? What geographies are most important in your view?
I'm going to disagree with the premise of the question. In this spirit, that place is the unique combination of some pretty common and universal phenomena. I would say it's everything. It's the economy. It's the politics. It's the culture. It's the social dynamics. It's all of that. We can only ever look at sort of one or two dimensions at a time. It's when you bring them all together in a volume like this that I think you appreciate the uniqueness and the commonalities.
And it's the physical setting as well. The physical environment of the region is so special that it influences who migrates here and then subsequently how they vote and behave. So that's part of what makes us special.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
Of course, we want to educate people and have people know their region better and what makes it special. But we also want them to know what we in geography do and why we do it. Basically, we want people to know that here we are as citizens competing and making decisions about our environment and our city. So the hidden agenda would be that we wish people would understand how these processes work so that they'll make better decisions for themselves.
I would echo what Dick said. We originally went to our colleagues with this idea for the book for a whole bunch of different regions, but one of which was absolutely to educate people about Seattle. And that's not to say that people who live in the region or who have been here know nothing. That's absolutely not what we're saying. But perhaps to present them with information in a more systematic format with a bit more depth or breadth, as the case may be. So it's sort of to improve on what they already know. The second agenda is to give a geography lesson in the sense of to teach people what geography is about. Nobody knows what geographers do, what makes a geographer a geographer. Why should we have this discipline in higher education in the U.S.? And yet, if anyone's ever had an aha moment when they look at a map, that's what geographers do. They give you that aha moment. They give you a spatial perspective on things or a perspective that relates the natural world to the social world. And that very often different way of looking at things in a very synthetic way is what geographers do. So it's not a specialized form of knowledge or a specialized discipline per se. It's more a specialized perspective on things that many people are interested in or study.
Is there any other aspect of Seattle geography that you think is particularly important to bring up for this interview?
So this is a show about sustainability, and I would say two sections of the book specifically tackle that question. And one is a chapter by Tim Nyerges, Kevin Ramsey, and Matt Wilson on GIS and regional transportation decision-making. GIS stands for Geographic Information Systems. And it's a very powerful way to map things. We don't use pen and ink anymore. We tend to use computers. And what Tim and his colleagues tried to do was to run an experiment where they gave people a whole lot of geographic information in a very accessible format around questions of how should we plan for transportation in the future? And they did an experiment with focus groups saying, if you had the power to make these decisions, how would you make them? And they got a whole bunch of people to actually practice transportation planning, but as ordinary citizens, but with this very, very powerful tool. And what they found was people tended to make very rational decisions. They tended to appreciate conflict and points of difference and competing viewpoints. They stayed within budget. And so it was a really kind of championing of citizens involved in decision-making around transportation, which, of course, I think is a very cultural attribute of this region. I think it reflects the cultural geography of this region. And then Kevin Ramsey reported on his doctoral research around debates over the viaduct replacement. And what he found was how powerful the discourse of automobility was. So even people who were for taking down the viaduct or improving it with transit. They themselves, as they engaged in public political debate, couldn't help but be sort of drawn into this norm, this way of talking about transportation that really focused on the automobile. And I think that might be rather surprising to some people practicing sustainability in the region around transportation issues. He kind of showed how insidious that discourse was.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, they should get the book and read it, of course, and look at the news from a more geographic perspective than they're used to. So, for example, once in a while, we have wonderful maps published in our newspapers or on the web, and people should look at those carefully, not just as where Baghdad is, but where Baghdad is in relation to Tehran and why Mercer Island votes Democratic when it's with all these rich people. That seems counterintuitive, and yet there's reasons behind it. So we want people to be able to think for themselves about that kind of question.
I think people will be frustrated if they approach this book as a monolith, as a text that has a single message. It was an edited collection. There's over 50 contributors to it. It's very polyvocal. For people, however, who know nothing about the area, maybe considering a move to the area, this would be a very powerful introduction to the region. For people who lived here, who've lived here for their lifetimes, I think they can learn more about the place that they already live. I think a lot of people will only be interested in certain chapters and certain sections of the book, and the book was written deliberately so that people could kind of dip in and out of it. It's very jargon-free. It's written for a popular audience. We were very deliberate in that. And that's tough for academics, but I think we succeeded. But if you're interested in rural areas, read the rural chapter. If you're interested in questions of segregation or the housing crisis or queer space, read the social chapter. If you're interested in global trade, read the global geography chapter.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Diane.
You have just been listening to Michael Brown, Professor of Geography, and Richard Morrill, Professor Emeritus of Geography at the University of Washington, and co-editors of the book, Seattle Geographies, published in 2011 by the University of Washington Press in association with the Department of Geography at the University of Washington. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.